Israel's survival, proof of the truth of the Bible. Mr. Chris Bailey has asked that we read together from the fifth book of Moses, Deuteronomy chapter 28, as an introduction to his remarks. That reading, dear friends, is an introduction to Mr. Bailey's address, Israel's survival, proof of the truth of the Bible. Mr. Bailey.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you for coming out to contemplate our subject this evening, the survival of Israel, proof of the truth of the Bible. To consider the nation of Israel is an interesting subject because by rights the nation of Israel should not exist. Some 2,000 years ago, or approximately 2,000 years ago, in AD 70, the nation of Israel was scattered from their homeland and dispersed throughout all nations, and an occupying force occupied the land of Israel. And if you wanted to destroy any nation, that's how you would go about destroying that nation. And yet, though scattered throughout all the earth in diaspora, the Jews maintained their national identity. Arguably the most hated and persecuted nation on earth, and yet for some 2,000 years they existed. They suffered religious persecution, they suffered political persecution, anti-Semitism led to events like the Holocaust, a deliberate pursuit to wipe the Jews off the face of the earth. And yet, come 1948, the Jews as a national entity declared independence once more in the land of Israel. How does that happen, ladies and gentlemen? An event which is unparalleled with any other national or nationality in history. I'm going to show you tonight, God willing, that that is nothing other than the hand of God at work in the nations of this world to bring about his purpose. It's easy to be sceptical on such a subject for several reasons. Firstly, the world at large are very eager to dismiss the fact that God exists. Secondly, we don't really understand how God works in the nations around us. When we speak of miracles, we think of miracles as defined by the Bible. Miracles that defy natural occurrences. For example, the Bible speaks of Moses splitting the Red Sea. It speaks of Joshua reversing the flow of the River Jordan. It speaks of the Lord Jesus Christ raising the dead, all events that cannot be explained by nature. But that's not how God works in the nations around us. In the days in which we live, God harnesses the power of nature to bring about a predetermined purpose. And we call that providence. It's when God works in the nations to bring about the purpose, such as restoring the nation of Israel to their homeland. For example, in 1998, there was war between Iran and Iraq, became known as the War of the Cities. And Iraq fired 189 modified Scud missiles at Tehran. The estimated death toll was some 2,000 people. If we skip 3 years later, we come to the first Gulf War, 1993. Iraq fired the same modified Scud missiles, some 80, so approximately half, at Saudi Arabia and Israel. The death toll was 31, two of which were in Israel. And we can ask the question, why such a discrepancy in death toll to Scud missile fire during the Gulf War? And we're not the first to ask the question. There's been around for many, many years the science journal called Nature. And come 1993, they asked the same question. Why was there so few casualties during the Gulf War in Israel due to Scud missiles? And so they wrote this paper. It's a scientific journal. They had to explain scientifically why there were no casualties virtually in Israel. And they took all sorts of things into account, like the changes in population density. They took into account the effectiveness of the Patriot missile system deployed in Israel. And despite that, they had to explain why missiles landed in Israel in the middle of a parking lot. Why missiles in Israel landed between two unpopulated buildings. Why in Israel a missile would hit a double-story building totally populated and fail to detonate. And this is their scientific response. Israel was lucky. Finally, simple good fortune may have played a role. Damage given indication of the role luck may have played. Luck will inevitably play a role. Israel's luck was probably relatively good. Luck will inevitably play a role. This is a scientific journal, ladies and gentlemen. I think if you were to go to scientific journals worldwide on any other subject and look for the word luck, you would have a hard time. And so you can see, ladies and gentlemen, to approach such a subject, we have to approach it with an open mind. Open to the definite possibility that God exists and that God is actually at work amongst the nations, bringing about his purpose, and that luck has very little to do with it. Why would he do such a thing? Why would he protect a nation like Israel? Well, simply, the nation of Israel are God's people. That's the short and the long of it. God created Israel. Isaiah 43 verse 1. Thus saith the Lord that created thee, O Jacob, and he that formed thee, O Israel. Fear not, for I have redeemed thee. I have called thee by thy name. Thou art mine, says God. Israel are God's people. And so he looks after them. The bottom quote, Isaiah 43 verse 21. This people have I formed for myself, says God. They shall show forth my praise. And that touches on another subject that we hope to deal with tonight, and that is why God created Israel. It is to show the world that God exists and to show forth God's praise. See, it's not coincidence that we're talking about Israel as a witness for God. Because God has expressly told us that we should tell the world that Israel's existence is a witness to his existence. Isaiah 43. O Israel, fear not. Ye are my witness, says the Lord. You are proof that I exist. And my servant whom I have chosen, that ye may know and believe me, and understand that I am he. I, even I, am the Lord, and beside me there is no saviour. Therefore ye are my witness, saith the Lord, that I am God. There's a purpose between God creating the nation of Israel. It is to teach the world, among other things, that he is God. Isaiah 44 and verse 8. Fear ye not, neither be afraid. Have not I told thee from that time, and have declared it? Ye are even my witnesses. Is there a God beside me? Yea, there is no God. I know not any. And so God is telling us specifically that we are to look to the nation of Israel as a witness to his existence and to his working amongst the nations to bring about his purpose. I want to spend the next portion of time just working through an event in the nation of Israel's history, pointing out some of the occurrences that really can only be explained as a whole as the purpose of God, or the outworking of the purpose of God. And if we look at it from that perspective, we can see the hand of God at work in those events. And those events took place in 1967 in the Six-Day War. Come 1967, the nation had declared independence for nearly 20 years. They'd survived their war of independence from a conglomerate of Arab nations, and by 1967, the Arabs were ready to go to war with Israel again. As the overhead says, on May 15, Israel's Independence Day, Egyptian troops began moving into the Sinai and massing near the Israeli border. By May 18, Syrian troops were prepared for battle along the Golan Heights. We have to not underestimate the situation that Israel was facing in 1967 in the Six-Day War. They were relatively few in number. They had Egypt and Egypt's army to the south. They had Jordan and Jordan's army to the west, to the east, Syria and Syria's army to the northeast, and Lebanon and its army to the north. Nasser, king of Egypt, as that goes on to say, asked the international force that was operating in Sinai to withdraw. May 18, they did withdraw. And as the Arab radio station proclaimed on May 18, 1967, as of today, there no longer exists an international emergency force to protect Israel. We shall exercise patience no more. We shall not complain any more to the UN about Israel. The sole method we shall apply against Israel is total war, which will result in the extermination of Zionist existence. See, their intentions are quite clear, as we can see in bold. An enthusiastic echo was heard May 20 from Syrian Defence Ministry. Our forces are now entirely ready not only to repulse the aggression but to initiate the act of liberation itself, to explode the Zionist presence in the Arab homeland. Down the bottom, the time has come to enter into a battle of annihilation. They were perfectly clear that their intention as a conglomerate of Arab nations was the destruction of the nation of Israel. May 28, Egypt closed the Straits of Tehran. May 22, Egypt closed the Straits of Tehran to all Israeli shipping and all ships bound for Eilat. This blockade cut off Israel's only supply route with Asia and stopped it, the oil flow from its main supplier, Iran. As you can imagine, the nation of Israel and its public began to panic. They were completely outnumbered. People were talking about the imminent destruction of the state of Israel, of a war in which there'll be an enormous number of casualties, at least 10,000 will be killed, says a general of the Israeli Defense Force. Rabbis in Jerusalem anticipated so many deaths, they actually designated all of the public parks in Jerusalem as cemeteries. Just before the war, the joke in Israel was, last one's out, turn off the lights. But this black humor didn't mask the fear that many Israelis genuinely anticipated a catastrophe. Israel found itself outnumbered and outgunned on three fronts, Egypt to the south, Jordan to the west, Syria to the north. The Soviets had poured $2 billion worth of arms into the Arab nations. Israel's enemies brought twice as many soldiers, three times as many tanks, four times as many airplanes to the battlefield. And so there was panic throughout the nation of Israel, which is understandable. Amidst such panic, there was one Israeli newspaper that ran this headline: God is watching over the Holy Land and salvation is near. That's fairly close to the truth, ladies and gentlemen, because God was watching over the Holy Land and salvation was near. And we know he spoke the truth because his words were not his words, but they came out of the Bible. So read in Jeremiah 30, verse 16. All who devour Israel shall be devoured. All of your foes, every one of them, shall go into captivity. Those who plunder you shall be plundered, and all who prey on you I will make a prey. For I will restore health to you, and your wounds will I heal, declares the Lord, because they have called you an outcast. It is Zion for whom no one cares. You know, the Bible uses one of its most powerful analogies concerning the nation of Israel. It uses the analogy of an eye. You know, the body goes to great lengths to protect its eye. The instinct to protect one's eyeball is one of the fastest and violent reactions known to the human body. And that's how God describes his relationship with his chosen people, Israel. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, after the glory he sent me to the nations which wasted you, For he that toucheth you, Israel, touches the apple of his eye. For behold, I will shake my hand upon them, and they shall be a spoil to their servants. And it's a warning to the nations that if they touch Israel, they will be fighting against God himself. And those words from Zechariah chapter 2 speak and somewhat explain the incidents that unfolded in what became known as the Six-Day War. And so on the first day of the war, Israel actually conducted a preemptive strike against Egypt. By 7:30 a.m., 200 Israeli Air Force planes were in the air heading towards Egyptian air bases. Though flying very low so as to not be detected by the scores of Arab radar sites, a Jordanian radar facility detected an unusually large number of aircraft heading towards the sea. The officer on duty immediately sent a message, INAB, the code word for war, to Jordan military headquarters in Amman. The message was encoded and passed on to Egypt's defence ministry in Cairo. Miraculously, however, the Egyptian coding frequency had been changed the previous day and the Jordanians had not been updated. Coincidence? Maybe, but more likely the hand of God looking after his people. On the same event, that morning, with the element of surprise in their favour, the Israeli Air Force obliterated 6 Egyptian airfields, 2 in Egypt proper and 4 in Sinai Desert, destroying 204 Egyptian planes, half of their air force. Though Egypt had sufficient anti-aircraft ammunition to destroy all the attacking Israeli planes, miraculously no order was given for those missiles to be launched. As it goes on to say, total air superiority was achieved by Israel on that day. You know, such events were not limited just to the southern front of the Six-Day War. But on the eastern front also, they had Jordan in the Sinai Peninsula. You know, it talks about the troops of Egypt running for fear of the Israeli army. But when we contemplate the number of troops that the Israelis actually had in their possession, one has to wonder what was actually going on. We have there the account of Israeli troops pressing on into the Sinai and capturing Egyptian outposts, and of Egypt abandoning their supplies and making a run for it. I found this statement rather interesting at the bottom there. An Arab tank commander surrendered his obviously superior army to an Israeli force of 12 tanks. He later claimed that while only a few enemy tanks were present, a desert mirage made him see hundreds. To someone that is familiar with the Bible, that would ring bells of other accounts of God working for his people. One that comes to mind is found in 2 Kings chapter 6, when the servant of the man of God was risen early and gone forth. Behold, an host compassed the city, both with horses and chariots. And his servant said unto him, Alas, my master, how shall we do? And he answered, Fear not, for they that be with us are more than they which be with them. And Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountains was full of horses and chariots and fire round about Elisha. What's to say that the events that are recorded in Scripture in 2 Kings could not have taken place on the Sinai Desert when God was once more helping out his people against those that touched the apple of his eye? So an interesting account of a tank commander who saw a mirage of many thousands of tanks. And as I said earlier, these events were not limited to the southern front, but also on the West Bank, facing the Jordanian forces. We get accounts of the Jordanian forces just surrendering for no particular reason. We have this account here that Israel is prepared for a long for a bloody and long battle when approaching Shechem. The city is heavily guarded and filled with tens of thousands of inhabitants, all prepared to fight occupation. According to Colonel Uri Benari, the army is very surprised when instead they walked into the city unharassed. At the entrance to Shechem stood thousands of Arabs who waved white handkerchiefs and clapped their hands. In our naivety, we returned greetings and smiles. We entered the town and wondered, we're advancing and there's no disorder, no panic, and the local armed guards stand by with rifles in their hands, keeping order. The crowd's cheering. It goes on to say, only later did I understand the residents of Shechem thought that we were Iraqi forces who were due to arrive from the direction of Jordan. The numerous enemy tanks were uselessly situated on the other side of Shechem. They woke up to their error too late. Coincidence? It could have been. But when we look at these as an overall whole, we have to be absolutely certain that although we can't be certain about individual coincidences throughout the war, we can be definite that the overall outcome of this war was definitely providential, and that God was at work protecting his people. Well, there are actually four fronts to this battle. To the north, in the Golan Heights, they were facing Syria. We won't read it all, but it speaks again of the Israelis being completely outnumbered and yet taking what were seemingly unassailable fortresses in the Golan Heights. It speaks of the ammunition hill, which was captured by an Israeli scout by mistake when he accidentally fell into a Jordanian trench on a moonless night at 2 a.m. and started shooting from the hip. Not only did this outcome seize the hill, but was the critical event that led to the capture of the old town of Jerusalem, including the Wailing Wall, some 30 hours later. And so we speak of the Six-Day War. We speak of it as a miracle, as providential, God working amongst the nations. The result? In 6 days, Israel captured the entire Sinai Desert, including the Gaza Strip from Egypt, Judea and Samaria, half of Jerusalem from Jordan, the Golan Heights from Syria. Instead of being annihilated, she had more than tripled her territory from 8,000 square miles to 26,000 square miles of Israel's neighbours. Lebanon alone, which did not attack Israel seriously, lost no land. So was it a miracle? Here's an interesting comment from an official at United States Military Academy in West Point. The United States military studies wars fought throughout the world. They do not study the Six-Day War because what concerns West Point is strategy and tactics, not miracles. So we're not the only people that understand or consider the Six-Day War in the light of being something that is totally unexplainable in terms of natural events. We can only stand back in awe of the fact that God is indeed working amongst his people to bring about a predetermined purpose. So that's the Six-Day War. And if we approach that with an open mind, it proves the existence of God, in my opinion. But what about the proof of the truth of the Bible? When we consider the Bible, we have to go back to consider what the Bible says about Israel, to consider some of the prophecies that the Bible has told about Israel and determine whether those things have actually come to pass. We considered some of the prophecies concerning Israel in our reading tonight. When they were created, God gave them a whole list of blessings and cursings, and we read some of those blessings this evening from our reading. God said to them, if they were indeed to follow his commands, God will set you on high above all other nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come upon you. You'll have perfect offspring, your flocks will increase, you will have complete victory over all your enemies, your land will be abundantly fertile and productive, you'll be established as the holy people unto God, all nations will be afraid of you, and you'll be prosperous enough to lend to many nations, and you will not need to borrow from them. We read that from the first portion of our reading this evening. But the second portion of the reading, and the majority of it, concerns the curses that were to come upon the nation of Israel should they not follow the commandments of God. And some of those curses include the following. If you will not obey the voice of the Lord your God, or be careful to do all his commandments and his statutes that I command you today, then all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. You'll have imperfect offspring, your flocks will decrease, you'll be diseased until you perish, you'll be defeated by your enemies, your land will be unfertile and unproductive, you'll be totally ravished by other nations, you'll always be afraid, you'll borrow from your enemies and will not be able to pay back, and you'll be scattered amongst the nations. And it's this scattering amongst the nations that we wish to consider tonight. You know, God gave them blessings and cursings, but he knew which way they would go. In fact, he told them which way they would go. In Isaiah 48, it says this, "The Lord of hosts is his name. I have declared the former things from the beginning, and they went forth out of my mouth, and I showed them. I did them suddenly, and they came to pass, because I knew that thou art obstinate, thy neck is an iron sinew, and thy brow brass. I have even from the beginning declared it to thee." God knew that they were a stubborn race. He knew that those commandments would not be kept. He knew that those curses would come upon them. You might ask, how can God, or how can the nation of Israel be a witness if they are to receive all those curses? Well, what we see is that the nation of Israel would be a witness to God no matter which way they went. If they were to keep those commandments, it says in Deuteronomy 28, verse 9, "Yahweh shall establish thee an holy people unto himself, as he hath sworn unto thee, if thou shalt keep the commandments of the Lord thy God and walk in his ways. And all the people of the earth shall see that thou art called by the name of the Lord." See, all the people of the earth shall see. That would be Israel being a witness to the existence of God if they kept his commandments. If not, all nations of the earth shall say, "Wherefore hath Yahweh," or the Lord, "done thus unto this land?" So either way, the nation of Israel was going to be a witness unto the existence of God. And so, unfortunately, as it happened, the curses were fulfilled. And in detail, this is the curse of them being scattered. "The Lord shall scatter thee among all people, from one end of the earth even unto the other, and there thou shalt serve other gods, which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, even wood and stone. And among these nations shalt thou find no ease, neither shall the sole of thy foot have rest, but Yahweh give thee there a trembling heart and failing of eyes and sorrow of mind, and thy life shall hang in doubt before thee, and thou shalt fear day and night, and shalt have none assurance of thy life." If we trace the history of the nation of Israel through diaspora, it's a very accurate depiction of their existence, of the persecution and the hatred that Israel faced. When the Jews were rich, they were classed as money grabbers. When the Jews were poor, they were classed as parasites. They were hated whithersoever they went. Their life hung in a balance, and they were fearful all their days. And yet, the nation of Israel is God's people. And he promised that although he scattered his people, he would one day gather them together. And so the regathering of the nation of Israel is foretold. Jeremiah 33, verse 26. "Thus saith the Lord, if my covenant be not with day and night, and if I have not appointed the ordinances of heaven and earth, then will I cast away the seed of Jacob and David my servant, so that I will not take any of his seed to be rulers over the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. For I will cause their captivity to return and have mercy on them." What that verse is telling us, ladies and gentlemen, that if the sun and the moon cease in their cycles, then God will forget about Israel. But if the laws of nature are fixed so that the sun rises in the morning, we can be guaranteed that God will gather the nation of Israel together. And we know it's fact because we've seen it. And in 1948, the nation of Israel declared their independence. Not only did God promise that he would regather the nation of Israel, but he also told us the methods that he would use. And so we have in Jeremiah 16. Therefore, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that it shall no more be said, the Lord liveth, that brought up the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. You know, that's quite an interesting statement, because that statement was known pretty much to the nation of Israel, that he brought them up out of the nation of Egypt. But the day is coming when the whole world will know that he regathered them from the four corners of the earth. This is what's going to be known. The Lord liveth, that brought up the children of Israel from the land of the north and from all the lands whither he hath driven them, and I'll bring them again into their own land that I gave unto their fathers. And that's exactly what happened. But you can see it's a witness to the earth. All the earth will see that God has done this. It will be proof of the existence of God and proof of the truth of the Bible. And this is how it will be done. God will send for many fishes, saith the Lord, and they shall fish them. And after I will send for many hunters, and they shall hunt them from every mountain, every hill, out of every hole of the rocks. You see, fishes rely on a lure. It's an attraction from the fish to come back. And so God's first step was to set incentives for the Jews to return from diaspora into their own land. Stage one, fishes. So in 1882, 1903, comprised of about, this is the immigration from various nations of the Jews to the land of Israel. 1882 and 1903, about 25,000, mostly Russian Romanian Jews, and was, not least, a reaction to a series of anti-Semitic pogroms in southern Russia. If we skip one point, we come to between 1919 and 1923, a further 35,000 immigrants, approximately, predominantly from Poland and Russia and the Soviet Union. They were motivated, among other things, by the Balfour Declaration and the associated boost for the Zionist project, which aspired towards an independent Jewish state. So these were minor events, critical but minor, in that they were incentives for the Jews, an invitation for the Jews to return back to their homeland. They were the fishers that God sent out to fish. But then the hunters came. And the hunters were more harsh. And between 1932 and 1939, around the time of the Second World War, about 200,000 Jews, they'd recognised the signs of the times, largely following an assumption of power by the National Socialists in 1933. They decided to leave their homeland. Between 1939 and 1945, around a further 70,000 European Jews from Poland, Germany, Romania, Hungary, Czechoslovakia succeeded in fleeing from Nazi terror. In the years between 1948 and 1952, just after World War II, more than 600,000 Jewish immigrants came to Israel, doubling the total population. And so God sent hunters and forced them back to their homeland. So there's a pictorial of the exodus of the Jews from diaspora back to their homeland between 1946 and 1951. And so God gathered Israel. Ezekiel 36, verse 36. Then the nations that are left all around you shall know that I am the Lord. I have rebuilt the ruined places and replanted that which was desolate. I am the Lord. I have spoken it, and I will do it. And so the world at large should be able to see that what God has done with the nation of Israel, that he's replanted them in their original homeland, that he built up what had fallen down, that he replanted that which was plucked up, and they should conclude the following, that God exists. And ye shall know that I am the Lord. But yeah, God is not finished with the nation of Israel yet. Yes, they've been gathered. Yes, they are a witness or a testimony to the existence of God and the fact that God works in the nations to bring about his purpose. But currently the nation of Israel do not recognize God as their God. They believe that they are in the nation of their homeland under their own steam. And so God still has a plan with Israel yet. See, the time is coming when God will educate his people in things of truth, when he will give them a new heart. They will turn back to him as their God and worship him in truth. I will make a covenant of peace with them. It will be an everlasting covenant with them. I will set them in their land and multiply them. That part has happened. And will set my sanctuary in their midst forevermore. That has not yet taken place. My dwelling place shall be with them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. The outcome will be a witness to the nations. Then the nations will know that I am the Lord who sanctifies Israel when my sanctuary is in their midst forevermore. And so we can look at the nation of Israel presently. We can see the work of God and we can recognize it as a witness to his existence. And in the future, when God has completed his plan and purpose with Israel, we'll see again that God exists and that he has wrought his purpose through the nation of Israel. God has a plan and a purpose with Israel. He has a plan and a purpose with mankind in general, and he has a plan and a purpose for you and I, should we desire to be part of that plan and purpose. We've seen that God absolutely has the power to work through natural means to bring about that purpose. Let us look into those things while we still have time to do so. Thank you for your attention.